Rick Antley, this is NHPR News at 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. In early November, the small southwestern New Hampshire town of Antrim added another chapter to the current national debate about wind power. Antrim residents voted on a proposed ordinance to restrict the development of large-scale wind projects in a rural part of town. And by a hefty margin, 61% of voters said no to the regulations. For years, a company called Aeolian Renewable Energy had sought to build 10 turbines in the area. The vote will make it easier for that project to move forward. And if it's built, the Antrim site will, along with up-and-running wind farms in Leominster and Dummer, will help New Hampshire's broader goal of boosting alternative power production. But as the wind industry gains more of a foothold in the Granite State, it's encountering more local resistance. People who might like the concept of green power, but are worried about the impact of large turbines on their local environment, rural character, and property values. And so, just as the industry gains more experience in presenting its plans to the public and working with local boards and state officials, activists opposed to wind power are also getting more sophisticated. Nationwide, they're sharing their strategies, struggles, and successes, calling themselves warriors in the wind wars. Today in The Exchange, what's next for wind power in the Granite State? Let's hear from you. How do you see this discussion over wind power changing as both the industry and those opposed to it gain experience? Do you live in a town that has a wind project or has shot down such a project or is thinking about building one? Tell us what's happened and whether you're happy about it. Give us a call, the exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, or send us a short email, the address exchange@nhpr.org. We have two guests. Lisa Linnows is here, Executive Director of Industrial Wind Action Group and publisher and editor of windaction.org, which tracks wind energy projects across the country and often questions claims made by the industry. And Lisa, nice to see you. Thank you for being here.
Thanks, Laura. Thanks for having me.
Also with us, Ed Cherian, New England Development Director for Iberdrola Renewables, an international clean energy company that builds and operates wind farms, including the one in Leominster, New Hampshire. And Ed, welcome back. Good to see you, too.
Good morning, Laura.
Well, and Ed, we've had lots of conversations over the past 4 or 5 years about the wind industry. Bring us up to speed now, Ed. Where do you see your industry today, whether in terms of projects getting up to speed, whether in terms of political support?
Well, since we spoke a few years ago, there's been tremendous growth in the wind power industry. Some 35% of all the new electrical generation that's come online in the U.S. over the last 4 years is from wind power, 35%. So although it's still a relatively small portion of all the power in the U.S., it's growing. It's grown substantially. In some states like Texas and Iowa, it's a substantial part of the power mix in those states. So the industry has grown rapidly, and although the economy and change is going on now, may slow that down.
Yeah, I read that even in 2009, in the depths of the recession, your industry, Ed, was booming.
We were booming. Some of that is due to carryover from previous years. The pipeline of project development has a long stretch, maybe 3 to 5 years. So projects that are engineered and developed and ready for construction may not come to fruition until the year after or 2 years after. And it's also a function of government support. The stimulus bill provided some support for solar and wind and biomass that has helped the industry to continue to grow.
And states like New Hampshire have passed renewable portfolio standards that require the state to have X percent of renewable energy by 2020 or 2030. That helps too, right, Ed?
Yes, it creates a demand for products like wind power or biomass or solar.
So, Lisa, to you, then, when the state and the nation really started focusing on alternative energy, you know, whether it's a decade ago or a decade and a half ago, wind and solar were always mentioned in the same breath, Lisa, as the best, greenest options. That was then. Where are we now in terms of how we assess wind energy?
Great question. There's not much has changed in terms of wind. It's still an intermittent resource. It still is a resource that needs a tremendous amount of land. And with the amount of development that has happened in the last 3 years, in large part because of federal subsidies that have been paying a tremendous amount of money, it's hitting up against limits in terms of transmission. So we have right now about 45,000 megawatts of wind in the United States. about 500 megawatts in the New England region by the end of this year. That represents about 2% of all of our energy. That's not a lot of energy, yet we're already, we still are dealing with fundamental basic limitations of the resource. So it's starting, the questions are being raised now, are we going too far into a resource that really can't meet our energy needs?
And a year or two ago, there was a documentary, I think it was called Windfall, where people were featured saying, you know, when I heard about this, I liked the idea of wind. I'm a green person. I like the idea of helping the environment. But then they started to change their minds. Do you see that, Lisa? People kind of wondering whether you should really paint wind a shade of green.
Great question. It's been happening more and more. And what we dealt with since the Carter administration, when really the push for renewables happened, a lot of money coming from the federal government to see us move towards green. We've all grown up with this idea that we have to get off fossil fuel and go to renewable energy. So everyone starts out with that mentality. But then you start to realize we're talking about enormous amounts of acreage being eaten up by wind projects, towers that stand 400, 500 feet tall. Who wants that in your rural area? And then the transmission lines, which I hope we talk about today, that is a huge impact that's being added to that.
Well, and I know Ed, I want to get in on this for sure. But Lisa, here's another question for you then. You know, it seems like everybody says they want to get off of fossil fuels, but people don't want Northern Pass hydropower. They don't want wind because they don't want it in their backyard. Biofuels have their own issues. I mean, if you're going to be so opposed to wind, what can you offer instead?
Well, the reality is we're going to be living with fossil fuel a long time. And I think what is happening right now is that people are understanding that we had this image or concept of renewable energy. It's a wonderful thing. But then there's a reality to it. And as we start to understand the reality, people can make more learned decisions about where we're going. I don't think anyone's trying to say we don't want renewable or we want more fossil fuel or more nuclear. We're just seeing the evolving process of people understanding more of what it means and then making more intelligent decisions.
So would you be as opposed if some of these wind projects were smaller scale in terms of either the number of turbines or the size of the turbines?
Yeah, but that's not where it's going. I mean, this is one industry. We tend to see in technology that things tend to get smaller and faster as they become more sophisticated. Wind energy happens to get bigger and more in your face, so it's not a technology that's going to get smaller.
Yeah, and Ed, I wonder what the wind industry is encountering as you go through this huge growth period. Do you also see you're coming up against local resistance?
It depends on a site. I mean, wind power, like anything else, there are appropriate places for it and inappropriate places for it. In terms of the question of land use, I'll give a specific example. One of the advantages of wind power is it allows farmers and loggers and others to continue to use their land as they do. So I would assert that, in fact, it does not consume or use a large amount of land. And I'll give a specific example, the Lemster Project. We leased 1,500 acres.
That's the one Iberdrola runs.
From three local farmers. And the retained lease is 44 acres out of 1,500 acres. So it's a very small amount of land. The land has continued to be logged and farmed. Some of it has conservation easements that came over it. So it's very compatible with the existing uses of the land. So it is not a consumer of land, as it were. One of Lisa's points is correct in terms of size. Wind turbines are large. They are large, and they are, depending on your view, they're in your face or they're elegant. It's a question of taste. And the technology is required to be larger in order to be efficient. And in order for wind power to generate electricity on a par with gas and coal and other subsidized industries, the scale of the technology and efficiency of the technology is critical.
All right. Lots to dig into. And I want to invite our listeners to join us as well. 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Or send us a short email, the address exchange@nhpr.org. We want your questions, comments, thoughts about where we are now in terms of wind energy after several years of tremendous growth. by the wind industry. 1-800-892-6477. Email again, exchange@nhpr.org. And Lisa and Ed, here's an email from Lorraine in Antrim. One of the main issues with industrial wind in New England is that by necessity it must be on our ridgetops. The sheer scale, she says, of these turbines is way out of proportion. Even if you are someone who likes the look of turbines, a 400 to 500-foot turbine on a 500-foot hill is visually and psychologically way out of scale. Lorraine says these massive industrial structures are simply not appropriate on our remote New England hills and ridges. That's the bigness argument again, Ed. It seems like people are having a hard time getting over that.
Well, there's a point to that. There's a lot of other structures on our ridges or even in our national forests that we take for granted in our everyday lives. Cell towers, microwave towers, ski developments, ski resorts inside national forests that are there and we accept. And so wind towers are large. Again, it's a question of taste. Is it appropriate or not? It depends. I think if you were to go to some towns where they have wind farms, you may find that most people are very happy with them. Some are not. I think it's a question of your perspective. Although in New Hampshire, for the most part, any viable wind power is going to be on ridges, there are large portions of other New England states where wind power is viable off of ridgelines. So it's not exclusive mountaintop wind.
Lisa, as we look at this idea of scale, I wonder, too, you know, who else is joining you in your efforts to oppose wind power? Are you kind of out there on your own, or are there other conservation groups that are joining you?
Well, actually, I would love to talk. I want to mention one thing about the roads, if I may. If we look at the Coas-Kani project, which is the one that's the Granite Reliable project that is under construction right now, that project has 33 miles of roads built linearly along three mountaintops. We've blown off the tops of the ridgeline up there to put those towers in, and those roads are the size of I-93. So when we talk about not taking up much space, linearly, that is a lot of road that's being built. So I respectfully disagree with Mr. Cherian, but to the point of are we alone, there are thousands of people just like me who are involved in this debate over wind energy. It started out as grassroots where people were concerned about the project themselves that was introduced into their community. But now it's much more anger and anxiety over these projects and the tactics taken by wind developers in trying to get their projects built.
Well, after a short break, we'll go to one town that has had such a debate, Antrim, that I mentioned at the beginning, which in the end did create the conditions where a wind project could go forward. So we'll talk about that after a short break. We'll take your calls to 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org.
Good morning. It's 9:19, and support for NHPR comes from you, our members, and support also comes to us from the Nashua Symphony Performing Brass Flourish, a program of traditional holiday music this Friday at 8 p.m. at St. Joseph's Church. Tickets at nashuasymphony.org. And from Holloway Motor Cars of Manchester, authorized Mercedes-Benz dealer featuring the 2012 E-Class, combining a signature blend of performance, luxury, and technology. BenzCars.com. More on what's next for wind power on the exchange on NHPR, then a 10 on the Diane Rehm Show, banning cell phones while driving. New Hampshire weather today, cloudy and breezy with some scattered showers, highs from 40 in the North Country ranging to 50 in southern parts of the state. Tonight, cloudy, showers ending, lows tonight from 30 in the North, 40 in southern parts of the state. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy and windy, some scattered snow showers most of the state, some sunshine and windy in southern sections of New Hampshire, highs from 30 in the North ranging to 40 in the south. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, the wind power debate in the Granite State. We invite you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. How do you see the discussion over wind power changing recently as both the industry and those opposed to it gain more experience as wind power grows? Also, if you live in a town that has a wind farm or has rejected such a project, or is thinking about one, tell us about your community's experience. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Our guests are Ed Cherian, New England Development Director for Iberdrola Renewables, and Lisa Linnows, Executive Director of Industrial Wind Action Group. And both of you, let's go to our callers now. And Frederick's waiting in Ringe. Hi, Frederick. You're on the air. Thanks for calling in.
Hey, all right. Hey, you know, I just would like to say, I guess some people think they're eyesores. I guess I wasn't sure, but when I was listening in, I guess some people do. I personally think they're beautiful. They're beautiful things, especially those really large ones, because I think of things in an engineering perspective all the time because I'm in that field, and I see that as one of the finest expressions of human creativity. You know, and let's face it, we're not hunter and gatherers anymore. You know, we're technical beings, we're technologically beings, we're linked, woven into the nature of this planet. We can't escape that. And I mean, this is one of the few things, technological things, that I see human beings have done which isn't screwing over our environment. So,
well, Frederick, do you have any near you?
No, but I would love to look at one every single day on the top of a hill. It's as important on top of a hill as a tree.
All right. Well, Frederick, thanks a lot for calling in. Lisa, what do you think?
Well, clearly he doesn't live near a turbine, but let's take the idea of the turbine itself. If he were told that it was impossible for that wind turbine to, as it's running, or 100 on the ridgeline operating, it still would not result in a reduction in of our fossil fuels by any large measurable amount. It still will not result in our decommissioning of our fossil fuel generation being replaced by wind power. And it really is not able to meet our load requirements.
Now, why wouldn't it? I mean, if we're going to get, let's see, I think I saw an estimate from the government that we could possibly get up to 20% of our electricity from wind power in the years ahead. You're saying that's wrong?
Thank you for asking that question. Yeah, the federal government has said 20% of our wind of our energy needs can be met with wind. However, you have to read that document. They're very clearly stating wind energy is an energy resource as opposed to a capacity resource, and I'll define that. A capacity resource is a source of energy that is capable of responding to our demand needs. So when it fires off, we can actually back down and replace our fossil generation. In the case of wind, because it's intermittent, it comes when it wants to, it disappears when it wants to off the grid, we cannot reliably expect it to be there. So the best we can do is displace our fossil needs, but all those fossil projects have to stay around when the wind's not blowing.
Well, and I want to let you jump in, too. Go ahead.
I don't agree with that. We talked about at the beginning that the many thousands of megawatts of wind power that have now been installed in the U.S. and the load, the demand for electricity has not substantially increased. So those thousands of megawatts of new electricity sources have been offset by thousands of megawatts of other sources being retired. And those are principally coal. They're principally coal. The other point to make is Ms. Lino says that wind is not a capacity resource. It is a capacity resource in many markets, including New England. Now, it is not a capacity resource for the full amount of its nameplate, but it provides base load and provides certain levels of power at almost all times of the day and night around the year.
I want to bring another voice into our conversation now and go to a town that's just gone through this discussion, Antrim, which we mentioned at the beginning of the program. Last month voted down a proposed ordinance restricting wind projects. And we go first to Brian Beal. He's an Antrim resident, activist critical of the proposed Antrim Wind Project. He also founded the website antrimwind.org. And Brian, good to have you. Thanks for your time.
Thanks for having me, Laura. I appreciate being here.
Well, first the vote, Brian. It did not go in your favor. Voters by about 60% said, no, we don't want these restrictions. What do you think this means?
Well, if you ask someone, are they in favor of wind power, you know, the answer 95% of the time will be yes. But as we've been hearing this morning, people forget there are a lot of trade-offs to every technology, no matter how feel-good it seems. In the case of wind, we have sound environmental impact and visual impact. And one of your listeners just a few minutes ago said, you know, he'd love to have one in his backyard, but you have to remember this is 24/7, 365, that you'll be hearing or seeing these if they are, you know, within a mile or mile and a half proximity of where you live.
But what do you think this means, Brian, the fact that so many people in your town disagreed with your point of view?
Well, there was a people do think that wind is a good thing. I thought that the developer that is moving the Antrim project along, did a very good job of financing, you know, yard signs and telephone banks and newspaper ads to defeat a local ordinance. That's how contentious this debate has gotten, that the developer would go to a local community and defeat a local ordinance. So, you know, there was a lot of money trying to sway the voters here in town. The developer has negotiated an amount of money that goes to the town should the project come to fruition. It's a complicated formula, but basically they promised $337,000 a year to the town of Antrim, two-thirds of which will go to the local schools. And people bought that.
Well, were the regulations that you were hoping to put into place, how strict were they? Were they no wind farms ever nowhere, or just no wind farms in this particular rural part of Antrim?
Well, there were two parts to our ordinance. There was Article 1, which was the regulation portion of the zoning ordinance called the Large-Scale Wind Ordinance. And that was a regulation how high they could be built, how loud they could be, from residences, how far they were set back for safety reasons, those types of things. The same type of regulation that you'd have if Walmart wanted to build a big box store in your town. The second part of it was to was an Article 2, which asked whether wind facilities should be prohibited in our rural conservation district, which covers most of the mountaintops in the western portion of Antrim. If that had passed, that would have prohibited wind in Antrim.
Because the hills are the windy places.
Correct. But the ordinance itself sought to seek balance between the need to regulate and the needs of the developer.
So what happens now, Brian? Does this project go through? Is it a done deal? And it's 10 turbines we're talking about, right?
Well, do remember that the New Hampshire Site Evaluation Committee has jurisdiction. And the ordinance would have influenced that. I mean, they would have reviewed that, but the state is under no obligation to use that. It would have governed future wind projects, maybe from other developers. But the state site evaluation committee now has the hearing scheduled for the spring, which will review Aeolian Renewables project. And our hope is that they take into consideration that Aeolian Renewables has never built one of these projects before. And we don't know what their financing is. And we hope, too, that since Antrim's wind resource is kind of mediocre, that they'll consider taking these down from what we anticipate is going to be a 496-foot turbine down to a more reasonable level. Basically, you know, smaller turbines are better for everybody that has to live with them, either visually or for sound or for safety. If these are built, we expect that they will be the largest in New Hampshire, the largest, the tallest in New England, and among the tallest in the United States, which is a real scary proposition for us.
So you're saying it's not necessarily no to wind in Antrim, but you would have liked to have seen a scale back of the project and so forth.
Well, there's certainly folks that don't want to see it built. I'm of the opinion that it likely will be built because the state wants to move these types of projects along. But I would like to see this scaled back.
All right. Well, Brian, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Have a great day.
That's Brian Beal again, Antrim resident and activist critical of the Antrim Wind Project. I want to bring the other side of this Antrim debate into our conversation. Jack Kenworthy, CEO of Aeolian Renewable Energy, based in Portsmouth, in partnership with Westerly Wind, has been trying to develop a wind energy site in Antrim. And Jack Kenworthy, thank you also for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me, Laura.
Well, you just heard from Brian Beal, and he said, look, you know, he's not opposed to wind per se, but this project is enormous and just does not fit the small rural character of Antrim. I wonder what you think about that.
Yeah, well, I certainly understand that there are some concerns that Brian has and that he shares with certain other residents in Antrim. I think, though, if you look at the overall scope of our project, it really is not by wind standards enormous really in any way. 10 turbines, you know, these projects do have economies of scale that are required to make them financially viable. And I think we've been very careful and cautious about how we site turbines, about how we choose our site locations in the first instance to ensure that we can, you know, comply with any kind of regulations that are going to be imposed upon us. So we do expect the turbines may be larger than other turbines have been installed that have been installed in New Hampshire before. But I think for the most part, you know, visually speaking, that difference is not going to be very noticeable, and we certainly are going to be able to comply with, you know, all the public safety and noise and flicker concerns that we expect folks to have.
So will you be subject to the regulations that any development in town, Walmart or whatever, would face, you know, how big it is, how loud it is, how it would be sited, roads and so forth? Will you still be subject to those regulations?
Well, the town does not have an ordinance right now that would regulate wind energy development in town. So the authority that's going to govern our application and issue permits for us to construct is going to come from the State Site Evaluation Committee. Obviously, the ordinance that the town had proposed in November was voted down. And in fact, in Antrim, there are no other noise regulations that apply to any other industry. So we are going to be regulated through the State Site Evaluation Committee process, and we're looking forward to getting that started in January.
Well, and as you know, Jack, this was a contentious issue in town and some bad feelings among residents on both sides of this. Could you have found some middle ground with those who opposed this project as you went forward?
You know, I think we made every effort to try and collaborate and work closely with the review committee and the planning board. Unfortunately, we weren't really offered a seat at that table. And so, you know, going into this, when the state asserted jurisdiction over the project in June, that really kind of rendered didn't render moot, but certainly took away the local jurisdiction to have the strict letter of an ordinance apply to our project. The review committee and the planning board felt it was important to advance a set of regulations that would essentially communicate to the site evaluation committee what Antrim residents wanted to see in terms of kind of key concerns related to the project. What we saw in the ordinance when we read through the drafts was that there were numerous sections that were very, very onerous and with which a reasonably sited and well-constructed wind project could never comply. And we made those concerns known to the review committee and the planning board on numerous occasions. And we never had the opportunity to kind of come to the table and have a discussion about how we might achieve a reasonable balance.
Well,
so I think what happened is that the town eventually came out and said, listen, planning board, we didn't ask to have unreasonable regulations placed on wind energy development in town. We'd like to see this project go forward, and I think that's what the result was.
Well, and if the project does go forward, Jack, what do you see as the benefits to Antrim and to the broader state of New Hampshire?
I think there are many. I think this is a very well-sited project that is not going to have unreasonable adverse impacts at all in Antrim or the surrounding communities. I mean, what we're talking about here is a 10-turbine project that's going to have a total limit of disturbance of about 65 acres. And within that area, these 10 turbines will produce enough power annually for about 13,500 homes. And that energy production will obviously be offsetting other energy that would otherwise be used from the New England grid, which saves the equivalent of about 18 million gallons of water every year, about 55,000 tons of carbon every year. We are finalizing negotiations with the town on a pilot that would pay the town roughly $330,000 a year, increasing each year in tax revenues. So I think all those things are pretty clear direct benefits, and then you have, of course, the indirect benefits of the kind of construction job creation that happens. We're working on a conservation package to accompany the project so that if the project is built, we're conserving land in the area, which we know is a local value. So
right.
I think what we're able to see is that we have multiple positive outcomes that are accomplished here with a very manageable, I think, set of impacts in a town that has a great deal of support for this project. And we're really fortunate to be in that position.
Well, and Jack, I'll wrap you up there, and thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
That's Jack Kenworthy, again, CEO of Aeolian Renewable Energy, based in Portsmouth, which has been trying to develop a wind energy site in Antrim. We spoke a minute ago with Brian Beal. He was an activist critical of the Antrim Wind Project. Let's hear from you, too. 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Or send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. And Ed Cherry and Lisa Lino's lots of calls and emails. I actually want to share a few of these emails now with you. This is from David. He says, my wife and I drove up to the wind farm in Leominster to check them out. That day, we heard an awesome whir and whistle when standing under the slowly sweeping blades. But when we drove a couple tenths of a mile away, we couldn't hear them. At their loudest, how far can they be heard? How far away are they a noise bothersome to most people? So I'll let you folks chime in on that. But here's another question from David. He says, remember that lighthouses could be considered and were once considered eyesores on our coastlines. Now they are generally cherished. Looking ahead 100 years, the same sort of people fearing new windmills now will probably be fighting to conserve the remaining examples of early 21st century turbines. Ed, I'm going to let you take first crack at the noise issue, and then Lisa, perhaps the noise issue, but also this, you know, we think they don't look good now, but maybe 100 years from now, we'll think they're lovely. Go ahead, Ed, on the noise.
You know, sound levels for wind turbines dissipate pretty quickly at some short distance. You know, we have landowners that are not involved in the projects that at Leominster, for example, that are only 12 or 1,300 feet away. And I've had no noise concerns, no noise complaints. And we did comprehensive sound studies both before and after the project was built. So it depends on the type of turbine and the type of conditions. But as I've said before in various meetings, I mean, we could be having this show right underneath a wind turbine. Yes, you would hear it, but it is not a screeching sound or an overwhelming sound. We have landowners that live hundreds of feet from wind turbines. So yes, you can hear them, but generally, you know, to be on the safe side, 1,500, maybe 2,000 feet, it's unlikely you'll hear anything because it at that point is subsumed by the ambient or background noise of wind through the trees, of road traffic, of water and other sources.
Okay, and Lisa, on the noise, and then later we'll talk about the aesthetics of this.
The noise is turning out to be one of the more significant impacts of these projects, and you hear from the wind developers exactly what Mr. Sherian said, and the fact is the people in Mars Hill, Maine, are living with turbines that are driving them out of their homes. They're living anywhere from 2,500 to 3,000 feet away. We have Falmouth, Massachusetts, same distance away, and the town has now decided to turn that turbine off. So there are issues. I'm not sure if I'm listening to noise. Mike, can we?
Yeah. We're running up to the break, and that's fine. We'll be right back. Give you a chance to finish that up. Also, lots more calls and emails, so keep it right here.
I'm Betsy Gardella, president of NHPR. We've brought you coverage of important events in 2011, from the Arab Spring to the budget talks in D.C. to the Northern Pass debate. Your financial contributions enable us to continue this kind of coverage in 2012. We know there are many organizations deserving of your support, and we're grateful that you consider us among them. You can make your tax-deductible gift online at nhpr.org. Thank you.
Support for NHPR comes from UR members in Lars Heating Systems, manufacturing boilers and water heaters for homes and commercial buildings for over 60 years. Built in New Hampshire with pride. Information at laars.com. From Applewild School in Fitchburg, Massachusetts, an independent K-8 school on 26 acres serving southern New Hampshire and central Massachusetts. Applewild.org. And Farnham Hill Ciders, real ciders, orchard made at Poverty Lane Orchard from True Cider Apples. Available at Barley Pub, Fiddlehead Farms, and the Portsmouth Brewery.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, an update on the wind power debate in the Granite State. Join us with your questions and comments by calling in at 1-800-892-6477 or emailing us exchange@nhpr.org. And Lisa and Lino's, just before the break, we were talking about, we keep getting back to this issue of noise. We had an email from someone who said he did not hear the noise as a problem. Ed Cherian said the noise in general is not a problem. You were starting to say, yes, it is a problem. I just wanted to let you wrap that up.
Yes, absolutely. And, of course, in Mars Hill, problem with noise. In Freedom, Maine, problem with noise. In Vinyl Haven, a problem with noise, as well as in Falmouth, Massachusetts, a serious problem with noise. In Mr. Cherian's own project in New York, the Hardscrabble Mountain, a problem with noise. And, of course, Iberdrola has come out and said, well, the turbines aren't actually the problem. It's the wind blowing through the trees that's keeping people awake. I mean, it's just silly responses. So people need to understand it's not when you're there in the middle of the day on a nice, clear day and the wind's not blowing much. Be there at night. Be there when there's ice on the turbines. Be there when the wind direction is coming in a certain way and a certain speed. It is quite problematic, and that's where we have the biggest problem.
Here's the second part of David's email. He said, again, lighthouses were once considered eyesores. Now we cherish them. Is it possible, Lisa, that at some point, you know, wind turbines will just be part of the landscape, like telephone wires and power lines and lighthouses?
Well, if you go out to California, it's part of the landscape. They're falling over. They're not decommissioned. They're simply not being used. In Hawaii, there are a number of turbines that are simply rusting out on the landscape, not used. But those towers are all smaller. We're talking about towers here that are 500 feet tall. They have a rotor swept space of the size of a football field. You don't get used to that. And I don't think that as long as they're standing many hundreds of feet above the tree line, you could have the one or two out there and people say, oh, yeah, it's beautiful looking at it. But when it's not working, when it's rusting out there, when it's half burnt and the developer's gone because all the subsidies are no longer keeping him interested in it, he's taken his money out of the project and he's moved on, what are we going to be dealing with? It's hard to know.
Is that better or worse, though, Lisa, than a coal plant, which, as we all know, puts mercury in the air, other toxins, contributes to climate change, and so forth? At some point, we need energy to power our laptops and turn the lights on.
The misrepresentation that Mr. Cherian said, that coal plants are coming decommissioned because wind power is coming in and replacing it, that's not a reality. That is not true. We're seeing a decommissioning of coal plants because coal is starting to become more expensive to maintain than natural gas. So they're coming down because they're coming down. It has nothing to do with wind coming in replacing them. So we will see a significant reduction in coal, I think, over the next 10 years because natural gas prices are coming down. But it's not because wind can't replace a fossil fuel or base load facility.
Aaron, I want to give you a chance to jump in, and then lots more emails and phone calls to go through. Go ahead.
Well, I think one of the things to point out is there are millions of people, not only in the U.S., but around the world, that live in and around close to turbines. There are many tens of thousands of wind turbines, modern wind turbines, all across the country. In states like Texas, at times it's as much as 25% of the power for the entire state of Texas. And Texas uses a lot of power. So I'm sure that there are incidents where projects have not been well sited or not well operated. But for the most part, wind power is used extensively in a number of different states without complaints, without sound issues, without concerns about visual blight, and mostly with welcoming arms by the towns that host them.
Well, let's move on to some other emails, and I want to thank David for that one. Here's one. Mr. Cherian states that turbines are in your face due to the size, but if you like them or not is a matter of taste. He says he lives on Vinyl Haven, where we have three 1.5 megawatt GE turbines, and I would suggest it is a matter of noise. He calls it incessant and disruptive. He asks, Ed, if you support reasonable setbacks and better noise regulations.
There are setbacks applied to every project, and there are noise modeling studies that are done for at least every one of our projects, so that a given type of wind turbine make and model is evaluated, given the topography and given the ambient noise, to determine what effect it may have.
So we're doing that already, you're saying?
We do that already for every project, and it has to be vetted in New Hampshire by the Site Evaluation Committee, and there's often follow-up requirements, follow-up studies that are needed. So that is already done for well-designed projects.
Let's take some calls. A lot of people waiting. And let's see, Jay is calling from Lovell. Is that right, Jay?
Yes, hello.
Hi, go ahead.
Good morning. Thank you for giving me a voice.
Sure.
Now, a couple of points, please. The wind, the sun, it's free. Point number two, where the government is giving these companies billions of dollars, if not billions, hundreds of millions, that's my money. Now, why doesn't the government write me a check for $6,000? I can put a couple of solar panels on my roof, put a wind turbine behind my house, 30 or 40 feet long, not going to bother anybody, and I'm going to get some free energy out of it. The truth is, these guys are not going to lower the price of electricity. Their electricity is more expensive. They're getting hundreds of millions of dollars of my money, and I've got to pay more money for my electrical bill.
So, Jay, not a problem with wind power, but more that companies are being subsidized. Is that what you're saying?
Look, you know, we gave trillions of dollars to the banks. You could have paid off every mortgage in the country with that money. This is a problem with the way government does things.
Subsidies. He says, hey, give it to me. I'll build a little turbine in the back of my yard.
Well, I think the bad news for Jay is that his money is also being sent in billions to oil and gas and coal and nuclear industries as well. There's no part of the energy industry, and in fact, there's almost no part of the agricultural industry or rail industry that are not the recipient of some type of tax break or grants or loans or favorable tax treatment. That is the way government policy has worked for many years to support one policy decision or another. So I understand his concerns about his tax dollars. I'm a taxpayer too, but his tax dollars, he's concerned about going to wind as many as five times that amount in tax dollars go to the fossil fuel industries.
Lisa, real quick.
Yeah, if Mr. Cherian would look at the Energy Information Administration's report from this year that looked at the amount of subsidies that went to wind power and renewables in the last 3 years, it dwarfs what was given to fossil fuel. But from our perspective, we'd say eliminate all the subsidies. Don't give it to wind. Don't give it to fossil fuel. And I could tell you one thing. The fossil fuel business will stay in business. The wind industry will fall flat on its face.
But is that bad for the country? I mean, don't we all want to get off of fossil fuels?
I don't have a problem with renewable energy. And yes, let's see if we can clean up our environment and clean up our fossil opportunities, which I think natural gas is going to be a big part of that. But the fact is we're subsidizing energy resources like solar and wind that are incapable of decommissioning, resulting in a drop in our use of fossil fuel by any substantial amount. Again, we get back to that intermittency, its remoteness, and the requirement to build all the transmission. And wind energy is extraordinarily expensive.
Here's an email from Siobhan who says, I lived on Maui for a while. Within the last few years, I came home to New Hampshire and can say that the wind turbines, though not organic themselves, have given majestic organic feels to the amazing landscapes of Maui. And driving through the plains in Indiana, I vividly remember seeing huge turbines on the top of a ridge visible from the other side of the island and watching them move on top of the ridge during a sunset. Maui is unarguably one of the most beautiful and sought-after landscapes in the world, and the wind turbines did not take away from that. It's a matter of seeing beauty in the whole picture. And Siobhan concludes by saying, wind turbines are a visible part of a system that promotes cleaner energy. It's something to be proud of and can become part of the greater scenery, though it may be awkward at first. Lisa, that's something that one of our earlier listeners said as well. We'll get used to it, and it does represent something that we can be proud of.
I really want to respond to that because what they're looking at in Hawaii is one project, 30 megawatts. We're not talking about a big project. It's about the size of Leominster. If we see our renewable mandates in the New England area, the five out of the six states that have mandates for renewables, we are going to see 9,000 megawatts of wind energy built in New England in the next 10 years. That's 4,500 turbines, 2 megawatt turbines. We'll see 4,000 miles of new transmission lines to deliver that to Boston and Point South. We're talking about a serious impact to our natural areas. And visualize that. It's not one turbine, it's not two turbines, and it's not one project. It's thousands of megawatts. And that's what our governors, who are well aware of this, and I'm not even talking about the cost, which is in the form of billions of dollars, our governors need to understand the reality of what our RPS policies are requiring.
So RPS, Renewable Portfolio Standard. So Lisa, real quick again, if they were smaller, would you have so much of a problem with it? Is it the size or is it the whole idea?
Yeah, well, let's talk reality TV here. We could dream that these wind turbines will get smaller, but they're not. I mean, Mr. Cherian made that point very clear.
All right, let's take another call. This is Doug in Barrington. Hi, Doug, you're on The Exchange. Go ahead.
Good morning.
Morning.
Thanks for including me. I realize that the media thrives on current conflict, but I'm thinking more about the future, and I think a lot of other people are too. I just recently attended two separate conferences on global warming, climate disruption in the seacoast. being on the seacoast of New Hampshire. And, you know, we're looking at being underwater in coming decades at the rate we're going. And I'd just like to interject that I think a potential solution to all these rancorous debates right now is large-scale development of offshore wind. This is being developed, being researched right now in places like the University of Maine. Department of Energy has done studies on this. They've looked at the intermittency of wind and said it's not a problem. We can link up wind farms. And we're talking about not dozens of towers, dozens of megawatts, but thousands of megawatts. The state of Maine has put out a proposal to develop 5,000 megawatts by the year 2030. That would supplant all of the existing power plants in the whole region. So, you know, the future is bright, but nobody seems to be talking about it. And, you know, I understand this is what's going on right now in New Hampshire and elsewhere, but we only have so many mountaintops. The offshore development potential is so huge. Just about everywhere you go, 5, 10, 20 miles offshore, is better for wind development than anywhere on the mountaintops. And this is U.S. Department of Energy studies. This isn't some tree huggers, crazy environmentalists talking.
Well, Doug, let me ask you a quick question, if I could, and I know you're an environmental advocate. Mm-hmm. What do you think about the people in Antrim who say, you know, look, this is going to ruin our property values, it's going to ruin our local landscape, bring it offshore? Sometimes when wind power is brought offshore, there are complaints there, too. I mean, this has been a huge deal in Massachusetts, as you know, also for boaters who say it ruins that sort of exciting boating experience of really being out on the wild waters. I don't know how long it took that Cape Wind project to get up and going. So,
yes, but it is up and going. You know, they've got
right, but it took a long
hurdles time.
Yeah,
that was the first case test. Now we're moving forward. There's a proposal right now to build a 5-megawatt single turbine off the coast of New Hampshire and Maine on Boone Island, you know, in the next 5 years. You know, yes, there would be permits needed to be gotten and all that, but you're not going to have the NIMBY effect. I understand that boaters don't like running into them, perhaps, but, you know, there are other things like lighthouses they have to avoid as well. We need to be thinking about the future, and we're talking about, you know, mega deaths, not megawatts.
Deaths from climate
change.
You know,
I'm just really, it gets distressing that people are talking aesthetics when we're talking about the future of the planet here.
Okay. Doug, thanks a lot for calling in. I appreciate it. Ed, and then Lisa, you want to jump in real quick on that?
Well, Doug's got a good point. There's, we can debate about fossil fuels and which are more efficient. And certainly gas prices are very low now. There's a shale gas boom going on in Pennsylvania and elsewhere. But the common theme there is that all of those energy sources, which are still going to be needed, I agree with Ms. Lanois on that, all produce more pollution or consume a lot of water or produce a lot of waste and continue to contribute to environmental impacts, which are not captured in their cost, to global warming. And in New Hampshire, we don't have any of those resources. We don't have coal. We don't have gas, at least not as recoverable. We don't have oil. So we're importing electricity or energy from one source or another. But over the last couple of years, and I think growing, is to look at what are the resources that are available in our state, the so-called three Ws. What do we have? Well, we have water, we have wind, and we have wood. And those are resources that are in the state that provide jobs for people that live in New Hampshire that, for the most part, can produce electricity without imports and with less pollution.
Lisa, what do you think? He says, look, you're worried about aesthetics, you're worried about noise. He says, I'm worried about the future of the planet here, the future of the human race.
I'm not worried about aesthetics in any way, the shape. It always comes up, and it's easy to point to it and say, oh, they're so ugly, we don't want to see it. But there are other realities that have to be acknowledged. Offshore wind, we like to talk about that. We're out there dreaming right now. There was a project proposed off the coast of Delaware that's been in the works for years. It got canned this year, this month, this week. And it was because of the cost of offshore wind. Cape Wind and the Deepwater Wind, two projects proposed off the coasts of Massachusetts and Rhode Island, respectively, may never get built because the cost is 4 to 5 times more expensive than onshore wind. And onshore wind is more expensive than natural gas. It is too expensive.
Expensive in terms of
the cost of electricity.
But what about Doug's point, the overall cost of climate change?
Well, let's talk about the overall cost. I mean, how... how much do we want to see the New England region stay a viable economy? Okay, right now, if we were to implement, and what's on the books right now, we have to meet state law for our renewable mandates between now and 2020. If we do that, we're talking about $15 billion in terms of new transmission to be built. We're talking billions of dollars in new subsidies going towards the energy, the towers being built. And we're talking hundreds of millions of dollars more in energy costs to cover the high cost of wind versus fossil fuel. What that means is our industrial, big industrial users are out of here. We're going to be out of, they're going to leave New England because of the sheer cost. We have already, but I want to make one more point. In terms of the economy, protecting the environment, we have already met the REGI compliance requirements that were set to be met by 2019.
That's
we're
the doing pretty well. Gas Initiative.
Correct. We're doing pretty well in terms of carbon emission reductions.
Well, and this has been a really interesting discussion, and we've gotten so many calls and emails that I was unable to get to. But Ed, real quick to you, I wonder, you know, is there a middle ground here? I mean, we've heard the concerns. Is there a middle ground?
I think the middle ground is having wind power sites that are appropriately located. And, you know, I think Ms. Lanois and I could probably agree on that. Maybe not specific sites, but there are perfect spots for wind farms. But perfect is not always easy to attain. So the question is, where is the right imperfect spot that is okay for the local community, is acceptable, and is appropriate for New Hampshire?
All right. Well, it's been really good to talk to both of you. Ed, thanks a lot for coming in.
Thank you, Laura.
Ed Cherry, and New England Development Director for Iberdrola Renewables. Lisa Lanois, good to see you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you very much.
Lisa Lanois, Executive Director of Industrial Wind Action Group. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our interns are Ryan Lessard and Karen Gohl. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange's executive producer is Keith Shields, and I'm Laura Kanoy.